right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. The investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. election took another serious turn Friday when the Justice Department announced the indictment of 12 Russian military intelligence officers for conspiring to interfere in the elections. VOA's Jim Malone reports.
Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein unveiled the indictment that was returned by a grand jury considering evidence brought by special counsel Robert Mueller.
The indictment charges 12 Russian military officers by name for conspiring to interfere with the 2016 presidential election.
The indictment outlines a sweeping effort by Russian intelligence to hack into Democratic Party email accounts and computers, including the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign. At a news conference with British Prime Minister Theresa May, Trump was asked if he planned to raise election meddling in his meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Monday.
But I will absolutely, firmly ask the question. And hopefully we'll have a very good relationship with Russia.
Trump went on to again slam the Russia probe. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
President Trump has declared the U.S. relationship with Britain as the highest level of special, rejecting reports of troubled ties further frayed by his comments published in one of the British newspapers, The Sun. Mr. Trump defended his remarks about British Prime Minister Theresa May, in which he reportedly said she ignored his advice on how to negotiate Britain's exit from the European Union. May apparently said she did not pay attention to the newspaper interview. The U.S. military is reviewing an airstrike it conducted in Syria's eastern Deir ez-Zor province after a human rights monitor said an airstrike left many dead. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the attack hit an ice factory near the Iraq border in an area controlled by the Islamic State. This is VOA News. At least 128 people were killed in a suicide attack at an election rally in Pakistan. The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attack, Reuters' Anna Bevan reports.
Tensions had been growing in Pakistan ahead of the anticipated return of the country's former prime minister, Nawaz Sharif, who was ousted by the Supreme Court last year and convicted in absentia of corruption a week ago. Sharif was arrested later on Friday with his daughter Mariam, minutes after they touched down at Lahore Airport. The pair had decided to return to Pakistan to face lengthy prison sentences in a bid to galvanize their beleaguered party ahead of the country's general elections on July 25th. Their return could shake up an election race marred by accusations that Pakistan's powerful military is working behind the scenes to skew the contest in favor of ex-cricket hero Imran Khan. Khan described Sharif as a, quote, criminal who deserves no support.
That's Reuters' Anna Bevan. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo led a high-ranking delegation to Mexico at a time when that country is in transition after elections, and both Mexico City and Washington seem eager to repair relations strained over immigration, security, and trade. VOA Cindy Sain reports.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo paid his first visit to Mexico as the top U.S. diplomat, saying it was a priority for him to come soon after the recent elections to meet with President-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Pompeo met with the leftist leader and with Mexico's outgoing president, Enrique Peña Nieto, and foreign minister, Luis Videgaray. The situation at the two countries' 3,200-kilometer border was a key focus of discussions.
The United States is committed to making measurable progress that ensures the security on both sides of that border.
Pompeo also said the United States will work closely with both the outgoing Mexican government and the new one to find a trade agreement beneficial to both sides. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
The fighting continues, but the International Organization for Migration says it has carefully assessed the situation in Yemen and, with the expert help from others, has been able to create a safe corridor to move a first group of migrants from Hodeida seaport. Eritrea's president has arrived in Ethiopia. It is another step towards ending a 20-year military standoff. Isaias Afwerki is expected to spend 3 days in Ethiopia. It's reopening the Eritrean embassy, and Monday, Eritrea was a former province of Ethiopia. It then seceded in 1991 after a 30-year war for independence. Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
This is a transition. We should not get comfortable. There's a long road to real democracy. And the first test of that would be fair and free competitive elections.
Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki arrives in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa Saturday.
Yes, there might be a few insignificant inexactities, but the fact of the matter remains, these allegations have not been proven otherwise. So all we say to them is, if you have alternative evidence, if you have alternative truth, if you have objections, if you have any opinion, please feel free to bring them to court so that you can be publicly exonerated.
Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio to soon establish a commission to investigate allegations of graft in the previous administration.
Come the day of the ballot, which in this case is 7th of October, he or she, meaning the citizen, in all freedom, is free to express yes or no.
And Cameroonian President Paul Biya announces he will be a candidate in the October 7th presidential election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki arrived in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa Saturday to begin a three-day visit. The visit is a major step towards ending a 20-year military standoff between the two neighboring countries. It came after Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed went to Eritrea last week, where the two leaders signed agreements on opening embassies, developing ports, and resuming flights. Eritrea is scheduled to reopen its embassy in Ethiopia on Monday. This after telephone lines linking the two countries were reopened for the first time in two decades. For more, I reached Dr. Dagnachu Waku, a lecturer at the University of Addis Ababa.
People are very, very excited here in Addis. I only saw what happened in Asmara through television. But here, I mean, especially the youth and everyone is very, very excited. And we have now a festive atmosphere. People are dancing out in the streets. So there is great excitement and hope, my friend. And it seems that the two leaders have finally come up with a plan to start a normal relationship, okay? It's more than a simple rapprochement. It's a major breakthrough, it seems. And eventually, the professionals, the diplomats have to sit down and establish a regime of sort so that both countries could, continue peacefully without any kind of conflict and contention. That's what the plan is as far as I'm concerned.
People are saying that it appears Eritreans and Ethiopians were not pleased with the tension between the two countries and the hatred over the years because they have families on both sides, and that could be the reason for the outpouring of excitement. Do you share in that assessment?
Absolutely. Two peoples are more or less identical in a way. I mean, we speak the same language and they've lived for many, many years together and all that. So there's a sense of we miss Eritrea from Addis Ababa side. I mean, people are ready now to rush to go to Asmara and Massawa and all that, okay? And the bonding is, historically, it's just... Eritrea was created in 1890. Eritrea and Ethiopia were one before the advent of Italian colonialism. And so there is this sense that we're back again. It's not like some sort of relationship with another neighbor. It's like a relationship with a country which is more or less similar. Eritrea is Ethiopia or Ethiopia is Eritrea. That is the psychology that I'm seeing here.
Talking about the diplomacy, Eritrea is expected to reopen its embassy this weekend, demonstrating the commitment of the two leaders and their decision to work together to better the lives of both Eritreans and Ethiopians. How significant is this from your perspective?
It is very, very significant. It's a major breakthrough. Hey, remember, we have about 350,000 soldiers confronting each other on the border, Now we're talking about establishing embassies and stuff, normal diplomacy and all that. So it's very, very, very significant. And I'm sure from there they will work out other modalities whereby a full-fledged relationship will be established between the two peoples, okay? So it is very significant. I mean, in the beginning, says an ancient philosopher, was logos, the words. Now, there is this outpouring of kind words between the two, and they're establishing an embassy. They will definitely soon open up the borders, and the soldiers will be back, and the whole area will be demilitarized, and the economic relationship will follow and all that. It's very, very significant for most people.
There are also suggestions that the reconciliation could transform politics and security in the entire Horn of Africa region, and that even the migration could also possibly be reduced significantly because of the reduction of tension between the two neighboring countries. Your take?
This would definitely have some sort of positive ramification in the region, okay? Both Eritrea and Ethiopia were supporting this and that group in the region, okay? Especially in the Sudan and Somalia and all that. Now, Eritrea coming up, you know, Eritrea and Ethiopia, along with IGAD and other stuff, could do constructive and positive politics to stabilize and establish peace in the region. So it is very, very significant, you know. And the other significant factor is that there is no third party, say, European or American power involved. I mean, maybe they're in the background, but what I'm saying is this is a major initiative by our Prime Minister, Abiy. It's a major initiation by Ethiopia and embraced by Eritrea. This is an African thing, an African resolving their own problem. You don't see a German chancellor or American foreign policy, holding their hands and telling them to do this and that. It is an African affair and it's an African solution. And in this regard as well, in this respect, it's very, very interesting as well.
Dr. Dagna Chiuwoku is a lecturer at the University of Addis Ababa. He spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Meanwhile, Mohamed Ademu is an Ethiopian journalist, co-founder and editor of Opride.com. He recently returned to Ethiopia after 16 years of exile in the U.S. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
After 16 years of absence, it is certainly overwhelming, almost dizzying. Much has changed in the country. There is a lot of movement here and a lot of optimism and a lot of hope. Quite a departure from what things have looked like a few months ago. So I'm glad to be back and glad to be back at this moment of renewal for my country.
What are the noticeable changes you see since you've returned?
I think the most noticeable change is in the sentiment of the people. People are hopeful, optimistic about the future. There is a sense of ownership. There is a sense of belonging. People feel as though now they have a government that listens to their grievances, a government that is willing to improve their lives, and a government that is promoting love and inclusiveness and belonging. The biggest change I'm seeing now really is that of sentiment and a narrative and what people say, the conversations around coffee table. There is that, but also some noticeable change in terms of infrastructure, in terms of development, at least in Addis, things that I've read about, but it's really always different for you to see things, to really believe it.
Eritrea's president, Afwerki, today started a 3-day visit to Addis Ababa. How has his visit been received?
There's a euphoric mood here all across the city. There is an Eritrean flag and Ethiopian flag side to side flying all across the Africa Avenue, the Bole Road, some of the landmarks here. And there were young people on the street, people on horseback coming into the city. The mood here is euphoric, but there's also there are mixed feelings. And, you know, the two countries have fought a war. But a lot of people seem to see the lavish welcoming, the euphoric mood as the price of peace. And this region of Horn of Africa really needs peace. And people seem to understand that and solving the Ethiopian-Eritrean stalemate.
What does this mending of fences between Addis Ababa and Asmara mean for the people of the two countries?
First of all, I think the human cost of this long-standing stalemate. It means separation of families, extended families. Now, with the flight due to start this week to Asmara, people hope to reunite with their loved ones, long-lost extended family members. That is the more immediate human cost of the conflict. But also there is hope that the resumption of economic and diplomatic relationship, Ethiopia will have yet another access to the sea, something that this country needs for an economy that is very much on upward trajectory. But there's a whole lot of need in terms of moving things in and outside of the country. And as you know, Ethiopia has relied exclusively on Djibouti for a very long time. And this opens up yet another opportunity, another access to the sea. And that means a great deal for this country, which has an economy that is growing, but also an economy that is more or less stagnating because the government-led development has done fairly well, but is reaching a bit of a dead end here, and they needed to stimulate it in another way. This seems to be part of that effort.
Would I be correct to say that as of now in Ethiopia, things are looking up?
Things are looking up. People are optimistic. People are hopeful about the future, and there is the overwhelming support for this young reformist prime minister, Dr. Abiy Ahmed. Every television organization, FM, people on the street, everybody talks about him. There are taxis as I drive around Addis here. Every taxi almost has bumper stickers of his photos and his sayings. Things are really looking up, and I'm really happy for the people because they really needed this moment in some kind of rejuvenation, something that gives them hope. So things are looking great, but of course there are concerns that it needs to be sustained, first of all, but also beyond sustaining it, this is a transition. We should not get comfortable. There's a long road to real democracy, and the first test of that would be fair and free competitive elections, and that process should start in earnest, and it hasn't. There is a concern, but there is a great deal of hope.
Mohamed Ademu is the co-founder and editor at upride.com. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Addis Ababa. The Sierra Leonean Information Minister says President Julius Maada Bio will soon establish a commission to investigate allegations of graft in the previous administration. The remark came after the president released a report which accused former President Ernest Bai Koroma of weakening the country's economy through mismanagement and corruption. But the former president has rejected the accusations as without merit. Meanwhile, the president has directed the Attorney General to constitute a commission of inquiry to look into the corruption allegations. For more, I reached Sierra Leonean Information Minister Mohamed Radu Swari in the capital, Freetown.
President Julius Maada Bio put together a multidisciplinary team of distinguished Sierra Leoneans. So they did a scoping study, and that study revealed widespread and egregious corruption, across all levels of government. So that report was presented to Parliament. The recommendations have been approved by His Excellency, so that a judge-led commission of inquiry will look into some of those very grave allegations that border on misappropriation of state funds, outright looting of state resources, and a whole lot of other malfeasance. Apart from that, the audit service thoroughly will also launch a forensic audit into the telecom sector, the two state-owned banks, the central bank, amongst others, while at the same time, the Anti-Corruption Commission will continue to fight corruption rigorously to the best of its ability. All of these investigations will go on concurrently to ensure that we do not have investigations that will span forever.
When will the president officially commission the investigation of this matter? Because Sierra Leoneans have been asking that people who have embezzled funds from the government should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law.
As a government, we are really heartened and encouraged by the loud applause from the generality of the population urging us to soldier on the war against corruption. So in the next few days, pretty soon, President Bio will commission this judge-led commission of inquiry to commence investigations in earnest. We can understand the impatience of our people. The country has suffered for far too long, under missile of successive governments, especially the APs. So we can understand the impatience. We can only appeal to them that this government is very focused, will not be distracted, and that the commissions will begin sittings in earnest. Modalities are currently being worked out and the necessary foundation put in place for the work to commence. So this is work in progress, and I'm sure we're in advanced stages of preparation to commence the hearings.
Who are going to constitute this committee that the president will charge to look into some of these corruption allegations made? Because some are worried that it could be partisan that could rather undermine the integrity or independence of the committee to investigate some of these concerns.
Well, all we can say to any skeptics, any pessimist, is that this commission will rise above board. It will be an independent commission that will have the necessary integrity to prosecute matters, you know, to the best of their ability. Mind you, this commission has the powers of a high court. A foreign judge will chair it, to be co-chaired by a Sierra Leonean judge. Many have argued in the past that the Sierra Leone judiciary is rotten, but we know that even in the worst of circumstances, we have very good edge. So even though the brightest of angels fail, there are still bright angels. We'll look for the very best in our judiciary to work with the foreign judge to ensure that these trials are expeditiously done so that the agony of the family members will not be prolonged for too long, and that those appearing before the commissions can get justice in the spirit that justice delayed is justice denied.
The former president has soundly rejected the accusations in the report, saying these are just made up to tarnish his reputation. Supporters of the former administration are saying it is a calculated ploy to tarnish the reputation of the former ruling APC party, and that this is all a political witch hunt. How do you respond to that?
This is part of the beauty of democracy. We promise to run a democratic government where citizens will have the right to express their views. That does not change the fact. Like the Americans say, if you find yourself in a hole, your best advice is stop digging. You have a situation where the former president has said he never had any involvement with the sale of the 30% shares in Sierra Rutai, you know, in complicity with his cousin. He has denied any involvement. Yesterday, his finance minister, Dr. Samora Kamara, was on air owing up that the shares were sold following executive clearance, and executive clearances are only issued by the president. So that's a denial, non-denial. On the other issues, I have heard the former attorney general say he was not in office at the time. So too was the former mayor. The thing that has not been brought into contention is the real thrust of the matter. Yes, there might be a few insignificant inexactitudes, but the fact of the matter remains. These allegations have not been proven otherwise. So all we say to them is, if you have alternative evidence, if you have alternative truth, if you have objections, if you have any opinions, please feel free to bring them to the court so that you can be publicly exonerated.
Mohamed Radu Sware is the Sierra Leonean Information Minister. He spoke with me from Freetown. Cameroonian President Paul Biya has announced on Twitter that he will be a candidate in the upcoming October 7 presidential election. If elected, the 85-year-old Biya would extend his long-time rule. He has been in power in the Central African country since 1982. But critics say he has failed the people of Cameroon following the ongoing crisis in the English-speaking regions. For reaction to the criticisms about President Paul Biya's candidacy, I reached Dr. Elvis Ngulengule, coordinator of the Academia for the Ruling Cameroonian People's Democratic Movement, or CPDM, in the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
In the declaration, he made it known that he was addressing himself to Cameroonians both at home and the diaspora, and that he was declaring his candidature conscious of the fact that there are problems, that he felt they needed to work together in finding solutions to these problems in order that Cameroon can continue to be stable and prosperous. And he said also that his candidacy was a response to the repeated calls by the people for him to run. He was therefore declaring his candidacy formally in the hope that Cameroonian people will join him and support him in carrying the work that he has begun.
Some people are saying, why should the ruling party choose him? The man is 85 years old. Some are even speculating that he is senile. What is your take on these criticisms?
As you know, the laws of Cameroon, the constitution included, does not make age a factor of being eligible or non-eligible as long as you are above 35 years old. But the maximum age, the law does not do that. Secondly, there is a question of legitimacy. We are a political system in which it is the people that decide. As long as the people have not decided, or however the people decide, we will know come 7th of October. The people have been asking him to run, and he is responding to the people's call to run as a candidate.
But, Prof, yes? This is what all other African leaders who have been described as dictators say. They said the people urged them to run, to amend the constitution and all that. Isn't this the same explanation you are giving me?
No, it's not the same case, because this is not a case of a dictatorship, because there has not been a dictatorship in Cameroon since democracy came to Cameroon. The people are always free to go vote either way. It is their choice.
Some Cameroonians are saying that the president failed in his core duty, which is to protect life and property and to maintain the territorial integrity of the Republic of Cameroon. And they said the ongoing crisis in Cameroon is a depiction that he has failed in his core duty, which he himself should decide is a disqualification for him. How do you respond to that?
The constitution permits him to run as a candidate. That's the first thing. Now, as far as protecting the lives and the territorial integrity is concerned, the socio-political situation in the country, which has created a security crisis, is a problem and a challenge which is known. And in every society, democratic or non-democratic, while there is such a socio-political situation which has created a security crisis, what do? We look up to the law. We look up to the constitution. We do not look up to guns. We do not look up to violence. We do not look up to killings. If you are faced with a socio-political situation, you don't do that. You look up to the law and the constitution. And the law and the constitution says this: if any citizen thinks that the one who is the incumbent has not satisfied his expectations or has not produced the results, come the day of the ballot, which in this case is 7th of October, he or she, meaning the citizen, in all freedom, is free to express yes or no.
How will people even accept the outcome of the election when a part of the country, although it's a minor part of the country, is in turmoil at the moment and elections cannot be readily administered in those areas?
Now, this is nothing new. The law and the constitution do not say that because there is a socio-political problem in one region or two, that there should be no election. No. There will be election according to the law. There were elections in Senegal, and yet there was a Casamance crisis. There was an election in Nigeria, and you know Nigeria's problem with Boko Haram. And these elections were judged to be democratic, legitimate, and legal. Cameroon cannot be an exception. This is just normal.
Dr. Elvis Ngole Ngole is the coordinator of the Academia for the Ruling Cameroonians People Democratic Movement, or CPDM. He spoke with me from Yaoundé. The Kenyan Wildlife Service has halted the relocation of black rhinos to a new sanctuary after 8 of the animals died soon after arriving at the site. Investigators are trying to determine what went wrong at the sanctuary located in the Kenyan Tsavo East National Park. For VOA, Rael Ombo reports from the capital, Nairobi.
According to the Ministry of Tourism and Wildlife, a preliminary investigation attributes the deaths to salt poisoning. They said the rhinos apparently drank water of high salinity in the new environment. Kenya Wildlife Service had recently transferred the rhinos from 2 other national parks in an effort to create a safe breeding ground for the country's black rhino population. Kenya Wildlife Service spokesperson Paul Gathitu told VOA earlier this week that all measures were in place to ensure the rhinos were comfortable in the new habitat.
There has to be sufficient food. It has to be correct in terms of weather, in terms of the water that is available. So all those factors had to be put in place, including even the issues of the security of the rhinos themselves. So all that put together, we felt that now the conditions were about right.
The 8 dead rhinos were among 11 that had been moved to the new sanctuary. Paula Kahumbu, the CEO of Wildlife Direct, said the deaths equal 1% of Kenya's black rhino population.
It's an unprecedented disaster. We've never seen anything like it before. So we're very anxious, very worried, and many, many citizens and concerned people in this country have been calling for an investigation.
Kenyans on social media expressed outrage and suspicion at the deaths. One Twitter user wrote, "Can photos of the dead rhinos be shared to ascertain the horns are intact?" Poachers have killed hundreds of the animals in recent years to satisfy black market demand for rhino horn. Kenya Wildlife Service has moved rhinos from one park to another in the past without incidents and successfully immobilized many rhinos for medical treatment. Tourism and wildlife officials are waiting for a full postmortem report on the diseased rhinos. In the meantime, the Ministry of Tourism and Wildlife says the remaining rhinos are being closely monitored by veterinary and park management teams and are being provided with fresh water in temporary pans. Ryan Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, according to the site Internet World Statistics, nearly 7 million Zimbabweans, or about 40% of the country, use the World Wide Web. Of these, 880,000 regularly use Facebook, with others using digital applications such as WhatsApp, Twitter, and Instagram. Young people make up over half of Zimbabwe's population and are a large component of internet users. With Zimbabwe's elections around the corner, new media is playing a considerable role in spreading information, especially among the urban populace. For VOA, Eddie Gondo has more on the story from the capital, Harare.
Against this background, the Zimbabwe Center for Media and Information Literacy recently held a summit to explore the potential use of new media in civic engagement. The theme of the meeting was reimagining civic engagement, youths, elections, and new media. Participants included new media experts and practitioners, foreign mission officials, civic leaders, and activists. Mangtati Mlochwa is an activist with the Women in Leadership and Development Organization. She explains how she uses new media in her work.
Learned how to embrace social media space to mobilize young people for whatever what I'm up to. So, for instance, the use of WhatsApp as a space of engagement. I run a WhatsApp group. Using this space, the WhatsApp group, we're able to then debate different political issues because the members or the people that are in the WhatsApp group are people from different political parties. So we're able to debate to drive engagement as well. I run a blog called The Radical Mandate where I discuss policy issues. So it's one of those things where whatever is available online where young people are found, we tap into it and use it to influence change. So that's how I'm using it in my small space as a young person.
Zenzile Ndebele is an activist and founder of the Center for Innovation and Technology. He is one of many individuals leading the new media revolution in Zimbabwe and helping to put the spotlight on matters of national interest.
I think I use social media for two main reasons. To get information on what is going on. I think the first thing that I do in the morning when I wake up is go on Twitter to find out the news from main news. I also use social media to create awareness on issues to do with could be human rights, could be, politics, could be things that are happening. If I go around, I see something, I take a photo and I tweet about it. So basically, I use social media to create awareness, to inform people on what is going on, to complain and probably sometimes to just make people aware that there's something that is happening. But also, I use social media to mobilize an opinion, to mobilize resources and all those kind of things.
One of the innovative platforms using social media for civic engagement is run by a young activist called Munya Dodo, otherwise known as Munya Blogo. He runs the platform Open Pali, which has been making inroads among the young and serving new media.
We are a monitoring platform. We monitor parliament. We try to hold our parliamentarians to account. We try to aggregate information from parliament to young people using social media. Open Parliament is an open data project, so we aggregate information that comes from Parliament. We live tweet Parliament sessions, portfolio committee hearings. We live stream them to our community and allow young people access into the corridors of power and give them full access to what ordinary people or what politicians get up to when they're in Parliament. It allows them to participate vicariously through social media.
One of the politicians using social media is the mayor of Masvingo, Hubert Fidze. He is a member of the opposition MDC Alliance and also a winner of the Communicator of the Year Award for his effort in engaging his constituents. He shares his experiences using social media.
New media, as it came, has actually assisted me in engaging and dealing with the issues of civil slavery with my residents in a way that we can interact anytime freely. Like in the case, I mean, almost 200 WhatsApp groups, so which are coming from the various groups of communities, be they the community in general, churches, artists, schools, etc., etc. So what they simply do is they relay their issues to the WhatsApp groups, then I pick up from there, then work out on the problems that could have been within the city, and as far as self delivery is concerned.
Okay. Once elected to public office, communication helps enhance transparency among politicians and civic leaders. In other countries such as Uganda, activists such as Prosi Kawala, who is with the Center for Media Literacy and Community Development, sees social media's potential for purposes other than political mobilization.
One way that we are trying to encourage our young people to utilize social media is actually to talk about or generate conversations about issues that affect them. They could be issues of unemployment, education, health, and we've done that really successfully because at my organization, we've put up what we call community structures. Actually, they're called community reporters. Those are young people. They live in communities. They study there. They work there. So what we do is we're encouraging them to use social media to report on those issues that happen every day in their communities. That will affect them. That will affect their families.
Social media has its downside, including the potential to spread fake news or to become a nuisance for some subscribers. But observers in Africa are watching to see if the new platforms will boost civic engagement and create new models for facilitating social dialogue. That's especially the case in Zimbabwe, which is trying to reform its political system in an era of rapidly growing internet usage. Reporting for VOA, this is...
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
But then the father is violent. Jumbo, we'll be fine, daddy. Your mother is black dot. She's a big character. Jumbo, I beg no bet for me. Your father is violent. Jumbo, we'll be fine, mommy. Your mother is black dot. She's a big character. Jumbo, I don't get so no more. Amaka, you know, one more Yoruba, let me know. If your papa don't want us to marry, your woman, no, you know. No, girl, I'm down for you, don't forget. The love me, I get it for you. Mama, no go compare.
Me, myself,
pray I get what.
Me, baby, broke as long as you love me. Girl, I dare you.
Me, myself,
but then your father is violent.
Jumbo,
you define that your mother is black dot. She's a big character.
Jumbo, I bet no better.
Your father is violent.
Jumbo,
we'll be fine, mommy. Your mother is black dot. She's a big character. Jumbo, I don't get so no more.
Oh,
tuitunze, nyumba yetu tuipambe. Hapo nyuma tulishindiaga mabwende, karanga na makande, nduru gali dona sembe. Usinune kwa maneno ya majirani wanoko, hawaishi longo, ni maneno kama viroboto. Wanakesha wakiomba unichape game kongoto, jamani sielewi. Spending my life, spending my life, spending my life. Kwani mapenzi matamu. Mapenzi matamu. Naomba uniroge, naomba uniroge, naomba uniroge. Kwani mapenzi matamu.
Where is my sœur à grande marque. Et là, mon poussé à Moyo.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, never underestimate the power of stupid people in large numbers. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. government, through the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, and the Malian government have reinforced their long-standing partnership in the health sector with the launch of the One Health Platform, which will address diseases that pose health security threats, including those of zoonotic origin in Mali. During the launch ceremony in Bamako, Mali, on June 21st, Prime Minister Soumaylou Boubaye Maiga expressed Mali's commitment to support the One Health Initiative and thanked the U.S. government for their commitment to the success of the program. The One Health Platform, which establishes and strengthens multi-sectoral coordination, is a key milestone in the Global Health Security Agenda, or GHSA, program, which was launched in 2014 to boost countries' capacity to prevent, detect, and respond to infectious disease threats. In Mali, GHSA works to increase the government of Mali's ability to prevent, detect, and respond to emerging infectious disease threats through the One Health approach. The newly launched One Health platform will coordinate One Health activities in Mali and help promote a multi-sectoral approach to health security across the ministries of health, livestock, environment, and agriculture, as well as six other involved ministries. Recognizing that nearly 75% of newly emerging infectious diseases in people are zoonotic, the platform supports the development of multi-sectoral standard operating procedures to prevent, detect, and respond to zoonotic diseases and can support emergency preparedness and response activities. This platform is just one example of USAID's investment in collaboration with other U.S. government partners, including the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and National Institutes for Health, in activities to strengthen the human and livestock health systems of Mali, including in the surveillance, laboratory, reporting, emergency management, and workforce development sectors. It is an innovative, multi-sectoral initiative for the prevention, detection, and control of health threats, including epidemics and other major endemics, said U.S. Ambassador Paul Folmsbee. The U.S. government has been proud to partner with the government of Mali on so many health initiatives, and we are particularly excited to see the One Health approach formalized with the One Health platform. We continue to look forward to working in partnership with all the sectors involved in human, animal, and environmental health to defend ourselves against outbreaks of pandemic potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From Washington.